Welcome to episode 90 of Take Note. This is our podcast about carrying around a notebook and writing things down before you forget them, and then reading them back to each other. And because this is a decasode, it's the 90th episode, we've got occasional co-host and current co-host and number one fan of the show, Ryan Sly, here with us. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here talking to people that don't live under the same roof as me.
And Adam is here, too, of course. Hello, Adam.
Hello. It's good to be talking to somebody other than Ted. Ted is really all I have, Ryan. And so I'm glad that every 2.5 months you join us.
That's the least I can do.
So here we are. And what we usually do, what we always do, in fact, is ask what we've been writing down in our notebooks. Ryan's going to start us off this week. So, Ryan, what do you got?
Well, so at the end of the school year, we went back to the school one last time to pick up everyone's things, and that included a bunch of schoolwork that the kids had done throughout the year. I'd like to read something that I wrote back then in my Blackwing vignette edition of Field Notes that I created. I wrote through that whole book with different Blackwing pencils. This was written with an 811. And it is a story by my, at the time, 7-year-old daughter, Lillian Sly. And it goes as such. Once upon a time, there was a witch named Kayla. They loved to cast spells like fireworks. More than anything, they wanted to leave because their town was full of zombies. The zombies kept spreading and spreading, and they couldn't get across. The zombies were like chocolate spreading across ice cream. So the witches decided to ride their brooms over the town, and it worked. The zombies were sent back, and by the second sunrise, the zombies were dead. Nothing will stop them. They were like towels laying on the ground.
Wow.
There's a lot happening in that, and yet nothing happening in that story. But I was happy with her obvious attempt at using some metaphors and simile, and it was very enjoyable for me. I had to write it down.
I thought chocolate spreading over ice cream was very visceral.
Yeah, that's when I think of zombies. It's just like that.
I think it's interesting how all of our children are obsessed with zombies, predating this whole situation we're in. Like they were already obsessed with like a apocalyptic scenario. And then
turns out they were spot on.
Yep.
Except for the whole happy ending part. Still working on that.
Now they're like towels laying on the ground. Adam, what do you got?
All right. I've got a really clever story by my child as well, with all sorts of metaphors. But instead of reading that, we are in our house. We are. I guess we're at the point in our quarantine where we're focused on our insides, which is not good for me because I have a long history of getting squeamish at any what I like to call inside stuff. So the other day, my child said to me, "Dad, I've got a question. If I pick my eye and stuff comes out, should I try to put it back in?" "Absolutely not," I said.
Like, let's work with the basic premise of the question. Let's take a few steps back.
Uh-huh. Yep. Don't pick your eye. Yeah. Ted, what do you got?
More parenting talk. That's all we've got these days, let's be honest. This was kind of a reflective note I made to myself. Parenting, colon. It's not inside stuff, colon. Adam.
Yes, great.
Punctuation.
Colon inside stuff is what got me in my sociology class when I was a junior in high school. I had to leave the class twice because I thought I was going to throw up. Colon-related stuff. Go ahead.
Parenting is planting a seed that you feel will bear fruit even when the kid in front of you is deflecting and even deriding your efforts. In my case, I was teaching my 8-year-old May about those little illustrations that run through every New Yorker magazine issue. I might have been reading stock listings for the disdain she heaped upon me. But I know, because I am a wise parent, that there will come a time when she will deploy this knowledge for good. It's my job to plant the seed, not to judge the soil or the day's weather.
What? So, how is she going to use the knowledge of the New Yorker spots for good?
I'm not going to say she will use the knowledge. That's maybe an overstep. But she will, I have to know or think or convince myself that 6 months from now, I will find her meticulously leafing through these old New Yorkers to cut out, you know, all of these little small illustrations. It's planting the seed. It's knowing that what you're saying now will be a subject of humiliation, insult, degradation, but that it will stick somewhere, like chocolate running over ice cream. The knowledge will run over her mind and seep in eventually.
This week, when my New Yorker showed up, Wiley thought that maybe he had received mail. And I was like, no, it's a magazine, but you could read the cartoons if you want. He screamed at me, Ted. He screamed at me for suggesting he might want to look at the cartoons. But I'm sure someday this knowledge he'll use.
The knowledge that there are cartoons, yes, in the magazine. Point of pride, May does ask, and this is all Caroline, her efforts. She asks if Roz Chast has posted anything on Instagram lately. Ryan, what do you got?
I would like to read a little story. We did go on a quick trip. We drove up to Arkansas and had a lake house there and rented a boat and stayed, you know, to ourselves there. Just with different scenery and, you know, a boat to goof around in, driving around the lake there. And it was great. But one day I went to Walmart in the neighborhood, took my mask and went over to Walmart to pick up a couple of things. And as I was walking around the store with my cart there, following the signs that directed me which way I could walk in each aisle, an older woman working near the self-checkout area saw my cart and not only let me know no beer on a Sunday, she also offered to and immediately removed the six packs of Sun Fox IPA I had in my cart and the 12-pack of Bud Light Platinum for our neighbor Todd, who lived in the boathouse next to our rental and had been very helpful and generous the previous day. Later, I wished I might have been a little more playful and perhaps trying to goad this woman who I imagine was named Grace about why you couldn't buy beer on a Sunday. So I wrote, "What do you mean no beer on a Sunday, Grace? You trying to ruin my day?" I'd ask. "Well, that's just the thing, son," imaginary Grace would reply. "This ain't your day. Sunday's the Lord's day, so you can't buy no beer on a Sunday."
The real victim in all of this is Todd.
That's true. He did eventually get his Bud Light Platinum, but not on that Sunday.
Well, and Ryan was trying to attack the Lord, so.
Well, that's how she saw it, I'm certain of it.
That's right. The no beer on Sunday always gets me on, it's not no beer on Sunday here in Illinois, but after a certain hour on Sunday, you can't get it. And it always frustrates me on three-day weekends. It's a Sunday night and I'm trying to get some beer or something and, you've got Monday off. And I've tried that. I've tried to negotiate with the fact that it's, tomorrow's a weekend. You just don't sell it tomorrow. They never go for that.
I mean, you can fill your Suburban full of 24 packs the day before, but don't buy it on that day.
Todd rolls up with a pontoon boat with Bud Light Platinum cans just spilling off the sides on a Saturday.
That's right.
What do you got, Adam?
All right. At the grocery store, the checkout guy asks me, are those Crocs? They are. I accidentally wore my big green backyard shoes to the store. And the checkout guy says, my pair are camo. I never wear them anymore. Thanks, kid. And this this inspired, since I knew we were having Ryan on the show, a Ryan-style list that I'm calling Are Those Crocs and Other Not-A-Compliments. So here are my other not-a-compliments. You got a haircut. I saw your I saw your presentation. I know someone who will love this. Wow, your car is orange. You really put yourself out there. This cheesesteak tastes like it was made by a sandwich artist. Unique. I couldn't have done it without you. And that's like a subtle one, but I think it's always important to remember that I couldn't have done it without you is not technically a compliment. And finally...
And usually not true.
Right. Finally, I see you like old-timey hats. And this has been Are Those Crocs and Other Not-A-Compliments.
Well done.
I'm still hung up on I couldn't have done it without you, which means I feel like you could have done it without me. So thanks.
Right. It could mean that, or it could mean I would have rather done it without you, but I couldn't have done it. Ted, what do you got?
All of your mistakes have brought me here.
All right. I've got a quotation taken from an eBay comment from a t-shirt vendor that seemed a little too good to be true. I went on a bender looking for band t-shirts. I wrote down a list of bands whose t-shirts I might want to buy. And I ended up on a Big Thief eBay page that seemed a little too good to be true. And turns out, according to this commenter, quote, is fake. No original, no fear.
End quote. No fear?
End quote. Yeah, no fear. I almost felt like, you know, sometimes an eBay comment refers to just the vendor and you don't know what they're actually talking about. But that person wanted an original vintage no fear t-shirt. but is fake, no original, no fear.
A Big Thief t-shirt, huh?
I was running down the line. I see. Well, okay, if you insist, I'll look at my list of bands. I cruised Wilco. They got some good stuff. Waxahachie. So-so. Joe Ely. Nothing to speak of. Rodney Crowell. Nope. Big Thief had some cool stuff. Krungbin is killing the t-shirt game. My only complaint being, perhaps, is they're not keen on putting the name of their band on the t-shirt. They're kind of the t-shirts that are so cool that they don't even look like a band t-shirt anymore.
They have a Texas Sun t-shirt?
No, they didn't. Actually, that would have been a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing too specific from Krungbin. Much more abstract. Much more... They had like Thai language phrases, you know, across the front. That sort of thing.
I think Krungbin is the way you want to go. I vote Krungbin.
It seems inevitable at this point. Ryan, what do you got?
So, as we've progressed through the queue, I've taken some periodic notes of strange things that have happened on certain days. So I'd like to read you a few of those, if that's okay. Indeed. Quarantine day 212, sorry. I've become a weird old man that yells at strangers through the front door. Quarantine day 500. I've been begging Lily all day to stop hissing at me. So far, no luck. Quarantine day 814. saw a man fly fishing in the front yard of the elementary school. It didn't even seem that weird. Quarantine 950. My book just closed on me, and I quickly reopened it to the exact same page. It was embarrassingly satisfying. Obviously, my days are, a bit hyperbolic, but all of the statements are actual things that have happened.
We can only hope to achieve quickly reopening the book to the same page. It's a state that we all strive for. I assume you've been meditating a lot for something like that to happen.
I was literally amazed with myself.
That's some transcendental stuff right there. So what are you writing with these days, Ryan? What are you writing with? What are you writing on?
So I have kind of shifted into, trying to use all the stuff that I have. I purchased my 10th fountain pen, a Franklin Christoff Model 20 with a fine SIG nib grind, and was promptly asked by my wife who Frank Christopher was and what that charge was on the credit card, and instructed to maybe lay off for a while, which had to happen at some point, frankly.
Classic cease and desist order.
Indeed, which I'm happy to comply with. So I've been spending a lot of time actually just switching off with my different fountain pens. I'm working at home, so I'm trying to use a different one primarily every day and kind of switching through all of those. I think before the shutdown happened, I'd purchased some old vintage pencils and stuff. So I've been playing with those a little bit and just kind of trying to enjoy everything that I have and mix it up a lot. And so mainly just still writing in my field notes and those Baron Fig notebooks that I bought to be my, what was at the time intended to be temporary work stationery, but now maybe indefinitely buying my own, which, yeah, is fine. But yeah, I haven't bought a whole lot of new stuff. I was just trying to, Ryan, really kind of...
What did the 10th fountain pen offer you that the previous 9 could not?
Well, see, it's different.
It's a different color.
And it has... Everything about us is different. Do you not understand how fountain pens work?
I don't understand how fountain pens work. We bought in our house, I don't know if we talked about this, but I bought the clear Lamy Safari, and my wife was like, I really like that, and she went and got it to his Bieco, and we keep doing that kind of thing. Like, we keep buying almost the exact same thing to copy the other person. Slippers. We did the same thing with slippers. Cool.
See, that's genius, because if you get her to try to one-up you, then, you won't get a cease and desist. You'll get, you'll have a healthy competition.
That's right. It's a healthy competition. I like to think of it that way.
A healthy competition and an unhealthy bank account, am I right? Okay. I had a fun experience with Adam Harris, who was on the show at one point. Good friend who's a fellow stationery enjoyer. We did a little ink exchange. So Ryan, you and I have done this as well. But we kind of exchanged our supply over the phone, and then he brought some inks over. But he had these great little glass jar, or these little glass, not quite a vial, not quite a jar, somewhere in between there. And it was fun, and he brought me the Mont Blanc Purple Beatles ink, which I haven't tried yet. I'm excited to. I tried to empty out my Twisby Eco to load up in this purple, and I ended up destroying it. Took it totally apart, totally deconstructed it. Gonna have to hit YouTube and see how to put that thing back together.
I can help you with that.
You could use "I destroyed my last 9 pens" as your excuse for buying the 10th pen. Just pretend you go through them a lot more quickly than you do.
Well, and I asked Adam Harris where he got these great little vials, and he said He's a whiskey connoisseur by profession, and he said it was a subscription whiskey service where this I can't remember the name of it, but they will send out, you know, 10 or whatever little mini jars of different whiskeys for you to taste and talk through and all this stuff from all different sources, which, you know, once again, notebooks, we ain't doing so bad here when you're talking about
right
giant shipments of whiskey traveling through the United States Postal Service or whatever. But they make great little ink jars. It's quite fun.
Cool.
What are you using, Adam, right now? What's going on with you?
Well, I've got this, I'm using the Field Notes Debtor Print and Craft Notebook. I've been writing short stories. Actually, I sent you the draft of one of my short stories, and I'm kind of happy with how it is. And today I started the next one, and those are all in the Craft Notebook. And I don't know. I think I mentioned this last week. And I've got a waterlogged debtor notebook, debtor print notebook. I fell into the water, into the pool, and splashed it. And I've been using that to take my occasional notes. And I have been, out of necessity, I've gone back to meditation. I've gotten pretty serious about it. So in between all my notes, there's an occasional really goofy thing that I've, like a just ridiculous thing that I've written after I come out of meditation. So I can be embarrassed about it now or later. But yeah, I capture an occasional meditative thought there.
Read those to us after we find a vaccine. How about that?
Should I check my junk mail folder for that first draft, or did you...
I'm gonna send it to you. I didn't know if it was any good. I'm not entirely sure, but I will. I'm getting a little more confident.
Yeah, it was
fair enough.
You know what, buddy? 95% of it was great.
Thank you. The only issue that I have with that is that I believe my wife thought the 5% that you did not like was in the 95% that she did like. So, Ryan, you may need to be the tiebreaker.
Well, Adam, you're really putting yourself out there.
So I've been reading a lot of Austin Kleon lately. He's I've probably talked about him before, but he's like a creative dude who's very enjoyable to talk about being creative and sticking to your work and motivating and just thinking about creativity. So I was reading his book, Show Your Work, and he's a proud quotation master, and he quoted someone who I can't even remember, who described their graduate MFA experience, I think in painting or something, as workshops in which their only goal was to be so harsh and horrible to the people that they were, whose work they were workshopping, that they would drive them out of graduate school altogether. And I thought to myself, I went to graduate school for writing, and I thought to myself, what a missed opportunity. If only we had taken on such an interesting goal throughout the whole process, I feel like we would have gained a lot more.
If your goal was of trying to push out one student?
If we all were all trying to push each other out the whole time, and we ended up surviving,
yeah,
I felt like that. I feel like that would have served a little bit more of a purpose than, you know, being supportive and
right,
and you know, appreciative and thoughtful and considerate and kind.
Yeah, I think you would have really enjoyed it. You would have made some really strong bonds if you'd all been at each other's throats.
I'm proud of us. We all read three stories from the recent, I think early June, New Yorker fiction issue in preparations for this episode so we could talk about them together.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited too, because honestly, this just started as I was trying to trick you into having to read a Haruki Murakami story, Ted. And instead, we all read three stories.
And the greatest trick of them all was that I really enjoyed the Haruki Murakami.
That's fantastic.
All right, will you run through who the titles and authors, Adam, if you would.
Okay. We read Confessions of a Shinagawa Monkey by Haruki Murakami, White Noise by Emma Klein, and Pursuit as Happiness by Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway. I feel like, was he one of the 30 under 30?
Yeah.
He was up and coming fiction writer.
30 under 30 in 1930. Yes. Yeah.
It was a good, they were all good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed them. I guess I'll just sort of say I had this wonderful experience of taking the New Yorker fiction issue into our inflatable pool in the backyard, often with a drink, and getting splashed by the children as I was reading, but also using the magazine as a way to block out the children. And it was fantastic. And then I sent you guys a scan of the fiction issue, the like waterlogged fiction issue of the New Yorker, which I hope you enjoyed trying to read the crinkled pages. But nice thing about a magazine is it dries out.
I think I enjoyed the Hemingway story that much more because it was waterlogged and beaten and battered. I feel like that thematically lined up with a tale about fishing for marlin and catching some, but they're not big enough, so you keep on going out and talking about the big one with your feisty sidekick, and
my
being a Hemingway story.
Yeah, my lowest expectations were the Hemingway story because it was a long lost mm-hmm. Hemingway story. Ryan, what did you think of it?
I enjoyed that one. I actually enjoyed all of them for very different reasons. I think, you know, the Hemingway story was fun. I liked, you know, the no social life, the NSL code that they're using with each other to keep him yeah. from going out and getting too drunk when he's supposed to get up and write. And, you know, the way that, you know, he mentions, like, they both call each other Cap interchangeably, and, you know, the encouragement that the guy that runs the boat gives him about his writing and all that kind of stuff was fun. There was a great non compliment in that story that was that he described some you know, his face that had not been sculptured for a quick or facile success.
I really liked the NSL part too. I liked the story. My expectations were low. And I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic that it seemed to be nonfiction or memoir, probably slightly fictionized, yeah. to the point that it was mm-hmm. it was like a story about the writing of The Old Man and the Sea, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It that seems not outside the realm of possibility. I didn't read any of the making of commentary to learn when the story was written, but sure.
Actually, two out of the three of these stories seemed like they could have been nonfiction in the fiction issue.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good point.
The other being White Noise by Emma Klein.
So you're saying a talking monkey is within yeah. the realm of possibility?
In case you couldn't figure out which one I didn't mean. Yeah.
Well, let's talk White Noise then.
So that was my main thing about that one, was that it seemed so much like it could have been nonfiction, and made me so, you know, uncomfortable just kind of being inside the day of this guy that's like oblivious to his own villainy and like made oblivious by his own sense of entitlement and ego, that it's just like, it made me feel gross reading it, which means it was really well written.
Yeah, the obliviousness, that's exactly it. The obliviousness of the Harvey Weinstein it's a story about Harvey Weinstein, the day before he gets sentenced. And the obliviousness, like, it almost makes you feel a little sorry for him because he just can't realize it. And I think it's pretty impressive that Emma Klein can make you feel almost a little bit sorry for this guy, and I think it's that obliviousness that does it. And then the weird, like, right to the weird twist that he sees Don DeLillo is his neighbor in the house he's staying at, and that somehow, like, infects this this true seeming nonfiction seeming story inside of Harvey Weinstein's last day before being sentenced. It's just such a bizarre little twist, and like a kind of a, I don't know, for the most part, the thing that does for me is just like, it's this fiction coming in and making you, like, it's a sort of reminder that it's all fiction and that you are reading a story.
Yeah. I mean, I thought in a weird way that the white noise story was sort of psychological realism, where, you know, you can almost in a weird way relate to the Harvey narrator character, essentially because he's talking himself out of responsibility, which I think, you know, every one of us has on some level or another, whether it's, you know, some bad choice you made, or you know, poor lifestyle choices made over and over again, you talk yourself out of the responsibility and you give yourself an out, and you create a narrative around it. And in some way, this is done in like the most extreme and kind of horrible of circumstances. But at the same time, it doesn't sound unfamiliar to say, oh, okay, who should I call? Well, if I call that guy, he'll say this. But if I call her, she'll be sympathetic to my plight. You know, there's this kind of weird realism to it that was very well executed.
Yeah, I think that there's a good balance, too, because there's all these points throughout the story where he's having to remind himself not to be a jerk to people so that they'll maybe forget, you know, the type of guy that he is and what he's on trial for. And, you know, and also a lot of little moments where he mentions things like, you know, having socks from the place where the Pope gets his, and things that, like, true, show his privilege and, you know, the extreme nature of his lifestyle.
I think one of the sort of simple things that made the story work for me, or at least allowed me to get into the story, was at first, I mean, maybe just the first, like, column of the short story, maybe a couple columns, I didn't know it was Harvey Weinstein at first. And there's a reference to Epstein early on, but I still missed that it was Weinstein at first. And I think if I knew right at the start that it was Harvey Weinstein, I don't know, I would have been deflated, and I wouldn't have been like, what is this? And like, eager to jump into it. But then once it became obvious, I was already into it.
I think that was true with the Hemingway story too. I mean, I think Hemingway, just everything that we know, everything that we bring into reading a Hemingway story prepares you for, you know, the character who is Hemingway-esque, but it will have, you know, he'll have some other very Anglican name, and it'll be displaced and all this stuff. It was almost jarring when he named himself, when the narrator named himself Ernest. It was almost sort of more Don DeLillo-esque of Ernest Hemingway than you expect of Ernest Hemingway. In a similar kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it had started out and you were, if it started out as Ernest, it would have had a different, I don't know, we would have taken to it differently.
Yeah, I mean, I had the hankering, even before this story, to go back and pick up The Sun Also Rises, incidentally, which is the only... I have most Hemingway books, but I couldn't find that one. Because I find that when I go back and read him, the older I get, the more I appreciate him, ironically. I think when you're young and you're introduced to him as this, you know, great master, and you're told over and over again how spare his writing is and how journalistic it is, that it sort of trains you to read him as sort of unemotional or not complex or something. But the more I go back to him as an adult, I feel like I can read more complexity into what he's writing. And I think I felt this way about this story too. If I'd read it when younger, I would have kind of been pointing to the stylistic components, but the older you get, the more you read between the lines, I feel like, and the more you start to say, well, why does this guy have a whole month? Why is he living month to month on fishing, or what is this dynamic that he's talking about, and how is he manipulating this power relationship with this fishing guide who's constantly willing to offer him less and less money? Just it's there's more there, I feel like, than kind of the 18-year-old version of Hemingway thought.
Well, Ted, I think you should tell us, since you're not a Murakami fan, but I think you enjoyed this story. Tell us what your thoughts were on the Confessions of a Shingagawa Monkey.
I thought he was very Hemingway-esque in describing his encounter with a talking monkey. What more can I say?
Okay. All right.
He's no, it was great. I mean, I think what I've struggled with in Murakami in the past is getting through his style, his sort of mundane fixation on the daily steps of human life. I mean, the one that the like when you say Haruki Murakami, I think to myself boiling spaghetti, because I could never get through the first 40 pages of the Wind Up Bird Chronicles, and hearing the narrator preparing spaghetti for what felt like the 18th time, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it. No, but I thought this was a delightful, punchy, interesting bit of magical realism that was just a fantastic short story.
And Ryan, do you like spaghetti, and what did you think of the monkey?
Spaghetti is great. This probably was the one that I enjoyed the most. I feel like the writing was as strange as the story, in that, the first half of it, or I don't that probably not exactly half, but whatever, at the beginning of the story, it's this just really enjoyable and funny description of him coming into the town, and this sort of weird scene that you get drawn into, where in a place where they don't allow people, they don't no guests after dinner at any of the hotels, and he's describing this place as ramshackle, and the repairs are slapdash, and I enjoy all these, the way he's describing this place with these, lesser used words, and then even the cat is falling apart or whatever, he's like his loud snoring or whatever, and it's all these weird things that pull you into this really bizarre scene where he's got a monkey scrubbing his back, and the monkey's wearing the I Love New York t-shirt and all these hilarious things and little phrases like maybe the monkey was a pathological liar. And all this stuff, which I found hilarious and was really like drawn into this so much. And then it just takes this sharp turn when when he and the monkey are sitting in the hotel room drinking beers together and getting into a serious conversation. Where, it becomes this thing about him stealing the names of his past loves, or people that he's attracted to or loved, and that distinction I felt like what became more and more important about whether it was people he was actually in love with or just attracted to, because if he's just stealing the names of strangers that he's got a thing for, like it's way more, like this predatory, strange behavior, even, in the context of it being something that you can't actually do.
I think,
So
I mean,
the difference is distinct. And then, he describes himself as having no name per se, himself, and that sort of made me wonder, was all of this started by someone that stole his name, or something that caused his original identity crisis that brought him to living with people and learning English and all the strange behaviors that you don't expect from a monkey. So it's like a real funny, hilarious start, and then a really kind of weird but interesting ending.
But even as you describe it, I mean, it's creating an interesting conversation with white noise, where you're, it's these two sort of predatory characters who are sort of rationalizing what they're doing. Now, yes, one does happen to be a primate, but they.
Which one?
But there's an intersection there of the conversations with a-holes, perhaps, something like that.
Or conversations with individuals missing something key.
Yeah. Well, and as I think about it, like the narrator of the Murakami story was almost sort of accepting, and I might be forgetting a few details here, but he accepting of the monkey's predatory behavior, mostly based on the fact that he was a monkey. If this had been a person, he would have thought, this is a monster. Whatever he's doing, identity theft or whatever kind of interpretation you could have, but because it's a monkey, he sort of gave himself some room for interpretation and contemplation, and oh, I, you know, he meets a victim of this kind of abuse and thinks, wow, I wonder if that was, I wonder if it was that monkey that I met.
And yeah, but wouldn't speak up because it's a monkey and you'd sound like an insane
Well,
person.
in a talking monkey's not that much different when you think about it from a celebrity.
What
I mean, it's like, famous, powerful producer has many of the same much of the same cultural cachet as a talking monkey.
what I like about
So Adam, you're the fan of Murakami.
And what
What did you
well what
think
I
of
like about that turn where suddenly you're hearing the story of the person who lost their name is that what precedes that, this whole monkey thing, the narrator is not just accepting of what he's doing, but he's accepting to some degree of the fact that he's talking to a monkey, right? He's not running out of the room. And as the reader, we accept it very quickly. And I think we're not thinking about, okay, what does it mean that he's a monkey? We're not trying to find any sort of meaning in it, or metaphor, or and maybe that's just me. But then you have this turn where you have this story about the monkey stealing people's names and the narrator meeting someone who can't remember their name. And that's the part that you're like, that's the part that you become focused on, sort of, what, if anything, does this mean? And that's what you're dwelling on, not the fact that there's this talking monkey who gives him a massage in the pool, and then they go back to the same room. And I think that's kind of what I like about Murakami, is that there's often this magical element that you get lost in, but you're not dwelling on it, and instead it's the other ideas that you that end up getting inside you. I did read the interview with Murakami that went along with this story online, and it turns out this story is a sequel to a story called Just the Shinagawa Monkey that they published in the New Yorker like 15 years ago. I did not read that one yet. But I thought that was amazing, that this was not the first talking monkey story that the New Yorker published by Haruki Murakami. So the origin story is out there.
that feels very Murakami-esque to for it to be a sequel of a story published 15 years
Right. I
ago.
mean, the idea that this story is not the one of a kind is amazing.
I mean, I'm surprised that the monkey in this story didn't say, You may have read the story, the first story about me 15 years ago in the New Yorker magazine.
Thanks for the beer. Stop me if you've heard this.
Well, it was, I mean, it was a great triptych of fiction. And, you know, if anything, I appreciate the prompt, Adam, to read all these because, you know, having a little bit of motivation to sit down and read through three short stories that are, you know, they had their own little universes and headspaces. And I think when you think about the short story, that's what you think about is like creating these kind of experiences for a finite period of time. And I do think all of these achieve that in unique ways. I do think they were very New Yorker-y ways. You know, there was nothing sort of challenging our views of the culture or society or justice or all the things we tend to think about right now. But they were all really good and, you know, of a high quality. And thanks for forcing us to read them through guilt and coercion.
Well, you're welcome. But you guys did sort of read into the monkey story that the monkey was a predator. Like, that was doing things to these women, stealing something from them. And then you're saying that in a New Yorker-y sort of way, that it wasn't challenging you. I don't know. Like, I did not get that from it. But you guys kind of took that from it. And it was sort of, it did sort of lead you to this, more so maybe than the Weinstein story, to this feeling of this monkey being a perpetrator of some sort.
You know, it makes me want to go write some more, which is a high praise for reading fiction when you're reading styles that are compelling and interesting. And that's what I plan to do, is go back and dig in on a project that I've been working on. So the inspiration is fun too. It's great to discuss it with you guys. Let's do this again, Ryan, in another 10 episodes.
Number 100, you guys. Hey, start planning.
Hey, any suggestions or recommendations for the 100th episode? Send us a note. Head over to takenote.space. Leave us a comment. What would you like to see, hear, learn about? Maybe we all read the stories from a New Yorker fiction issue from 1993. You never know what kind of crazy stuff will happen on this podcast. Adam, let's do this again next week. What do you say?
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you, guys. Talk to you soon.
Check us out on takenote.space. Check us out on Twitter, twitter.com/takenotepod. Things get hot over there. Oh, I want to acknowledge Adam's viral tweet. Check out Adam's hack for the heavy duty edition of Field Notes, the latest. You'll enjoy it. That's on Twitter. Scroll through our Twitter profile and you'll find it. And we will talk to you later. Goodbye.